Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. What is the relationship between the New Hampshire primary and the New Hampshire media? That's the question tackled in a recent episode of NHPR's podcast, Stranglehold. And today in The Exchange, we bring you that episode called The Newsroom. Then we'd like to hear your thoughts. How do you feel about the way New Hampshire's media covers the primary? Where do you go to learn about candidates? We'll hear this 20-minute episode, and then we'll open it up to you. So send us an email in advance. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or tweet us. And now let's hear this episode, The Newsroom, from our podcast, Stranglehold.
Hey, it's Lauren Chulgen. And as I write this episode, we are only a few weeks away from the New Hampshire primary, which means it's also about the time when candidates are starting to get a little desperate. There's only so many more chances to close the deal with those powerful first-in-the-nation voters. And there's this thing that every candidate hopes for, a thing that could help win over some undecided voters or give a candidate some last-minute attention, an endorsement from a New Hampshire newspaper.
For years and years, it was not uncommon to see voters carrying an editorial cut out of the Monitor, and I presume other papers, to the polls with them.
Ralph Jimenez is a longtime editor at the Concord Monitor. It's a daily newspaper out of New Hampshire's capital city with a pretty strong reputation. And for decades, the editorial board at the Monitor, so a group of top managers separate from the newsroom, they've been entrusted with this big responsibility. They sit down with the candidates one by one and basically try to get them off their stump speech. They ask tough questions that maybe the candidates don't hear on the campaign trail about issues that affect New Hampshire voters. And at the end of all these conversations, the board gets back together and they fight over who they think would be the best president. And then they print a piece in the paper that explains who they think New Hampshire voters should go for. Other papers would do this too.
Best thing that can happen is to walk into a coffee shop and hear people arguing over the editorial or over the endorsement.
Presidential candidates want as much exposure as they can get in New Hampshire. And here they could get the stamp of approval from the editors of a trusted newspaper. And sometimes that leads candidates to get competitive, like in 2008.
There were five members of the editorial board, and we were split between these two candidates, and the campaign knew it.
Felice Bellman was the top editor at the Monitor then. 2008 was an open race, so lots of candidates on both sides. And the Republican choice was going to be easy. The board knew they were going to endorse John McCain. But on the Democratic side, they were already torn between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And that led to one crazy week in the Concord Monitor newsroom.
On the Monday, I believe, of that week, Hillary Clinton came and sat for a long editorial board interview. And then the next day, Bill Clinton, who happened to be in the state campaigning for her, came just to make the case for his wife, and he sat with us for 2 full hours. That was like a Tuesday.
Later that week, it was Barack Obama's turn. He comes in, sits before the board, does the interview. But apparently, as he was getting ready to leave, an editor let it slip that the Clinton campaign had given them more time.
When I got back to my desk after that Obama interview, my phone was ringing. It was Barack Obama himself. Saturday morning of that week, I was awoken. My landline phone was ringing, and it was Hillary Clinton on the other end. She woke me up. The farther you get away from that year, that was 2008, the crazier it seems. But in the moment, it seemed completely like what would go on.
Well, I'm here. He's
okay,
not.
Well, and I can't tell who I'm running against.
This is Stranglehold, a podcast about the power and people behind the New Hampshire primary. And I gotta say, this is an episode everyone on the Stranglehold team has been thinking about for a long time. Because this story is a story about us, about the New Hampshire media. We can't dig into the primary without picking apart one of the most essential pieces of this powerful institution. And as we held up the mirror to ourselves and our colleagues, we started to really see just how much the media has helped maintain the so-called stranglehold and how we've all benefited in the process.
You end up being part of the First in the Nation industrial complex.
The notion of like exclusive access by local press is definitely like not what it was.
I was a biased reporter. I will own that proudly. I was a biased reporter.
So we've made the case to you many, many times over that New Hampshire thinks it's special, that the First in the Nation primary gives us this extra relevance or power and maybe a little bit of ego that doesn't usually come along with living in a small state. It's why, for decades, young, green reporters would move here, even if they weren't super jazzed about the prospect at first.
I don't know. I just thought that I was like hot.
Is Sarah Koenig. And in case you don't recognize her voice or her name, maybe this will ring a bell.
For the last year, I've spent every working day trying to figure out where a high school kid was.
Before she was host of the mega hit podcast Serial, before she was a producer at This American Life, Sarah Koenig was looking for a job at a big city newspaper.
Yeah, summarily got rejected by paper after paper after paper.
It was the 90s, and she tried to get a gig at the Baltimore Sun.
And he said, we can't hire you yet. You don't have enough, like, daily experience. But, like, here's a list of really good smaller papers that you should apply to. And I think the Monitor was on there. So I was like, okay. And I did exactly what he told me to do. And the Monitor was interested, and I was just like, oh, New Hampshire. You know, I thought I was fancy, and so I was like, this little paper is like beneath me or something. I mean, I was such an idiot then. And then
she thought more about it, and something clicked.
Oh, right. First in the Nation primary.
I've got one thing in mind, to earn every vote I possibly can, and to win those most important primary of New Hampshire.
Today, I announce that I am a candidate for President of the United States.
2000 was going to be a big election year. It was a totally open race. President Bill Clinton was finishing his second term. There was, of course, an impeachment trial. So while local newspaper jobs would usually mean a lot of reporting on town hall meetings, car accidents, maybe a fire or five, in an election year, New Hampshire reporters get to cover the potential leader of the free world. Alec McGillis is now an award-winning reporter at ProPublica. But in the late 90s, he was another young reporter looking for a job at the Monitor. How much of the thought process was, well, it would be really great to cover a primary? Or were you just kind of looking for a job anywhere you could get it?
No, I would say it was definitely probably a good sort of third of the calculus in going up there.
At the time, local coverage was often the first and only source of information for New Hampshire voters. Think about it. This is 2000. That year and for decades before, voters weren't scrolling Twitter or reading national papers online for campaign coverage. The Concord Monitor had a really loyal readership. So local editors at the Monitor and elsewhere, they really saw themselves as an integral piece of the primary complex.
They really did regard themselves as kind of as somehow guardians of the process and guardians of the privilege.
I don't think I needed to be told, like, this is important. Like, here's our special role. Like, it was so drummed into you constantly.
It was up to New Hampshire reporters to inform the First in the Nation voters. Those voters relied on the local papers to get basic information on the candidates. They could read side-by-side comparisons on issues, features on what candidates did before they wanted to be president. And there were, of course, reports from local town halls and house parties.
For weeks, it was just all day, every day, you were at events and events and events and events and just driving all over the place and talking to the candidate, talking to their campaign. I mean, it was just, it's a frenzy. Mm-hmm. And you felt super important.
So the connection between the local press and the voters, it also helped build another important relationship, the one between the local press and the candidates. And the currency that relationship provided was incredible access.
How are you?
Happy to do it.
Thank you very much.
You'd have these campaign events where you'd have the entire national press corps there, that huge pack coming in from out of town, and they would be clamoring to get to talk to the candidate. And you as the young local reporter would be sort of secreted away, waiting for your half hour alone with him, because you were entitled to a level of access that much more experienced national reporters were not, because in that period, your readers or your viewers mattered more to the campaign than whoever was reading the Washington Post.
I would bet that every former New Hampshire political reporter has some sort of story like this. A moment where you, the New Hampshire reporter, were chosen ahead of or instead of national reporters. You mattered more. Your news outlet mattered more. Because your readers, the New Hampshire voters, mattered more. The point of the interview was to give readers a sense of who this candidate was, but it was also pretty cool for the reporter. The stories that would come from those interviews, they could influence the campaign, make national news, and they'd definitely help you get your next job.
I had clips about George Bush in my backyard, you know what I mean, who had just been elected president of the United States. So, like, I mean, I feel like the primary ended and I sent out my resume.
But this is the part in the story of the media and the primary where things begin to get a little sticky.
You end up verging into a little bit just being part of the kind of first in the nation industrial complex, and you've got to kind of avoid that. There were definitely moments where I could feel, even the monitor, which I love the monitor so much, but you could feel us sort of becoming a little bit part of a whole kind of shtick.
Let me give you a quick example. Sarah remembers a story she did at the Monitor about Michigan, about how they were trying to kick New Hampshire out of the first-in-the-nation spot. So you may remember this. Secretary of State Bill Gardner was involved, the so-called guardian of the primary for the last four decades. And Sarah wrote a story about him and how he was trying to keep Michigan from stealing the primary.
I remember sort of my stance was like, go Bill Gardner. You know what I mean? Like, he's our guy. I'm sure I brought up, I in the stories, I was like expressing Michigan's position, but I wasn't really interrogating ours.
Sometimes reporting on the primary can turn into defending the primary.
At the Democratic Convention, will you support New Hampshire's continued first in the nation?
You guys
status?
Are really good at bribery, man. I tell you what.
Yes, this is the quid pro quo that I'm asking you for right now.
I don't have any quid or pro.
That's coming up after the break. Hey, it's Lauren, and this is Stranglehold. We've spent a lot of time this episode talking about the Concord Monitor and their important role as an intermediary between voters and candidates. But for as long as we've had the primary, over 100 years now, there's been a lot of local coverage of it. For example, in 2000, when Sarah Koenig and Alec MacGillis were on the beat, the Monitor wasn't the only game in town.
If you think about that time period, when candidates came to a given region of the state, there would be, you know, the statewide news outlets, the Union Leader, to some degree NHPR, WMUR. You'd also have local papers, regional papers, papers like Foster's.
This is my colleague Josh Rogers. He's been covering politics in New Hampshire for nearly two decades. And when he started out, New Hampshire, like many other states back then, was full of local newsrooms who covered every inch of the First in the Nation primary.
You would get some people who would cover minutiae of campaigns, staffing changes, like, you know, who was endorsing who. You'd have people who would be writing something that, you know, might have more sweep. Different papers, you know, cover things with different intensity. But, I mean, the bottom line is there was more.
There's a joke that gets told around here that politics is like our state sport. It's part of our culture. The New Hampshire primary is seen as this, like, good thing, a public service that we provide for the rest of the country. And somewhere along the line, New Hampshire journalists started seeing themselves as participants in that thing, instead of neutral observers. And that can shape reporting on the primary in subtle and not so subtle ways. Like reporting that perhaps in hindsight should have been more circumspect. Remember Sarah Koenig's example?
I remember sort of my stance was like, go Bill Gardner. You know what I mean? Like, he's our guy.
We've done boostery sounding stories here at NHPR, like this one from 2016, celebrating the importance of the, quote, humble house parties.
Why is it that in an era of big data, big money politics, candidates still see value in these smaller, more informal gatherings?
You do, in New Hampshire, still pick up votes
We also did a profile of Gardner that year that barely questioned him. But then there's this.
When it came to protecting the presidential primary, I was a biased reporter. I will own that proudly. I was a biased reporter.
Scott Spradling was WMUR's political director for 12 years. And WMUR, or Channel 9, is New Hampshire's only statewide television news station.
If John McCain's plan is one step at a time.
Full disclosure, I interned and freelanced there in college. Now, New Hampshire voters can get Boston stations, too, but when it comes to the primary, WMUR is king.
Mitt Romney introduced himself to Concord retirees by talking.
They report from the campaign trail. They air lots of interviews with candidates. They often invite voters to join them for those conversations. And they co-host national debates, so they do a lot.
Good morning and welcome to Close Up New Hampshire. For the next 2 weeks.
And when Scott Spradling started at WMUR, he says at first,
I tried to just sort of be a filter for what I was hearing and then, like, reflect it back so that people could make up their
own
minds.
And then you fell in love.
Well, yeah. I mean, I fell in love with the primary because, my gosh, she's such a lovely mistress.
But this deep love for the primary would often pop up in his coverage. He gave me one example. Before the 2000 election, he was assigned to go down to Delaware. You remember Delaware. They wanted an early primary, too. And the guardians of the New Hampshire primary told candidates, if you campaign in Delaware, you will feel the wrath of the New Hampshire voter. And how were the voters going to find out? Scott Spradling.
The point was, my news director sent me 5-6 hours south to go camp out in Delaware and wait for a gotcha moment. The whole thing was supposed to be catch the guy in the act, show the people of New Hampshire that he's running around with somebody else.
Turns out, didn't work out. He didn't get the story, but that's not the point. The point is, for Scott Spradling, protecting the New Hampshire primary was part of the gig. And he says that's true of WMUR political directors through today.
100 years after ballots were cast in New Hampshire's first presidential primary, the tradition is under fire again. Despite recognition,
you can hear it in the station's 2016 special commemorating the 100th anniversary of the primary.
In a country plagued by voter apathy, New Hampshire is tirelessly engaged and well aware of the responsibility.
You can hear it peppered throughout regular news coverage.
So there's no perfect system, obviously,
right,
other than the first in the nation primary, I should say. But
and in interviews with candidates.
At the Democratic Convention, will you support New Hampshire's continued first in the nation status?
You guys are really good at bribery, man. I tell you what.
Yes, this is the quid pro quo that I'm asking you for.
I don't have any crow or quid or pro with you.
Remember, the New Hampshire primary is a political institution, protected and upheld by powerful people who stand to benefit from its survival. And so reporting that doesn't interrogate that institution, well, it seems to apply a different standard to the primary than to other important political forces. But Scott says when it comes to the primary, that's the way it should be. Why is it okay to not be objective about the fact that New Hampshire's first?
Well, I guess because in this particular argument, I would say respectfully that the results speak for themselves. I think that New Hampshire, for a number of unique reasons, small makes it affordable. It's
Scott's argument about why it's okay to be biased about being first, it's one you've heard throughout this podcast. Scott says New Hampshire is small, accessible, gives long shot candidates a chance. He says New Hampshire makes better presidents. Now, some of those things are facts. New Hampshire is small. It is easy to get around here. Candidates have campaigned in New Hampshire on a shoestring budget. But whether our voters make better presidents, whether we deserve to be first, those are opinions. No one who works at WMUR now would sit for an interview with us, but the station's news director, Alicia McDevitt, sent us a statement, and it reads, quote, the first in the nation primary is a big story because it's a New Hampshire tradition. These are lines taken out of our broader reporting of the New Hampshire primary. WMUR does not take positions. We obviously cover those who support the New Hampshire primary and their reasons for doing so. But that does not mean we take an editorial position, end quote. Part of what we're trying to do here now with Stranglehold is take a step back and put all of this, every piece of the primary, under the microscope to find out what's behind the assumptions, ask the questions that make people here uncomfortable. And some people certainly are not pleased with that tact, including local journalists like Joe McQuaid, editor-at-large of the New Hampshire Union Leader, the only statewide newspaper that we've got. Here he is recently on C-SPAN.
The local public radio station in New Hampshire did a podcast this year called stranglehold.
McQuaid wouldn't do an interview with us for this episode.
And it's a series ostensibly, well, it's about the New Hampshire presidential primary, but it's very negative about the primary. And I'm wondering, all the people in New Hampshire who support and listen to that station, what are they getting for their buck? I listened to two episodes and stopped listening because I was no longer interested.
Now, I would argue what we are doing is not negative, but I understand why my colleagues would be mad or at least baffled. The primary has made New Hampshire's local media important. All local media. Us too. It's boosted careers, helped raise money. In the 2016 election, WMUR sold $28 million in primary-related ads. We dangle the primary when we're recruiting reporters to our station. We use it as messaging during fund drives. And when the election rolls around, we are in demand. In the 2012 election, my colleague Josh Rogers made nearly $20,000 filing extra stories on the primary for National Public Radio. And Josh has got just as many stories of insane access to candidates as anybody else does.
You know, in 2004, you know, the Howard Dean campaign like rented a sports bar in Manchester and invited reporters to, you know, kind of hang out. You know, I shot pool with Howard Dean. Like, what candidate would think that that was a good use of their time? I mean, it probably wasn't a good use of his time then, but the idea that it would be considered a good use of your time now, you know, seems kind of preposterous. I mean, you can.
But now, Josh has noticed a change. The access he and other local reporters used to enjoy, it's just not the same.
When I first started, like, it was not uncommon for, like, people who were, like, press secretaries for people to actually give comments and interviews that were, like, kind of useful, potentially. And now, like, you know, that doesn't really exist anymore.
Why? You already know the answer. The internet, social media, the way we all consume news now, the high thresholds being set to get on the debate stage.
They don't need to build the kind of relationship that they had historically with local media. And while getting an endorsement from a paper is something that any campaign would want, I think they also know that the record reflects that, you know, those things may not make a hell of a lot of difference.
I actually wouldn't be surprised if this is the last real New Hampshire primary, but that's a debate for another day, I guess.
The Concord Monitor used to be a place candidates looked to for that coveted endorsement, a place where multiple reporters would fight over who got to be assigned to which candidate. But now, their campaign coverage is either purchased from a national wire service or reported by one part-time freelance writer who also files for other outlets.
As long as I can remember, reporters angled to get a good candidate because they would follow them around for days at a time.
You were at events and events and events.
Report on their every movement.
Driving all over the place and talking to the candidate, talking to their...
And now there are three, four, five times more candidates than reporters.
Editor Ralph Jimenez says that the Monitor doesn't even have enough people to form a proper editorial board. And that's why this year, for the first time in decades, they're not going to bother endorsing a candidate.
The staff is so reduced that on any given day, we couldn't get four or five people together, even for a top-tier candidate. And if you can't do all of them, or most of them at least, it's not fair to just do a few and write about them. So we're forced economically to pretty much take ourselves out of the game for endorsement purposes.
I guess that, like, obviously that you need the candidates to show up for the primary to be important. You need indications that voters take it seriously for it to be, like, facially credible. You arguably no longer really need the local media telling that story to make a difference.
Even if the press corps isn't what it used to be, and the candidates don't care as much about local reporters, as long as we're first, there will still be something to cover.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're looking at the media's role and how the New Hampshire primary plays out. With me in studio is NHPR's Josh Rogers, our senior political reporter. And Josh, we really appreciate you helping us out. Thank you so much.
No problem, Laura. Good morning.
So we heard in the episode about the declining influence of the New Hampshire media in the New Hampshire primary. How would you describe that role today, Josh?
Well, I mean, there's certainly plenty of people out reporting the primary from the start. I mean, one thing is that you know, campaigns have much easier time bypassing the media in general than they used to. These campaigns take place, you know, on a national, on kind of a national level on cable TV, and national outlets send reporters up here earlier than they used to. This primary, we also have a bunch of candidates who are really truly national figures. And so the window of time in which candidates are introducing themselves to folks in New Hampshire and using the media to help do that, you know, it's gotten smaller and smaller.
So given all the other sources of information that people have, Josh, including direct information from candidates through their Facebook pages, their websites, and then people have their social media accounts, this sort of, it's kind of opened up a lot of other players, hasn't it? We have less of a mouthpiece than we used to.
Well, I mean, the media is less of an essential, you know, intermediary or membrane through which information passes from candidate
That's
to
a good
voter.
Way to put it.
And
yeah.
So, and the membrane is also smaller in terms of there are just absolutely fewer local reporters than there used to be, both, you know, period, but certainly covering politics in a full-time way.
Interesting. Again, I want to remind our listeners that it's your chance to weigh in about how the New Hampshire media, or the media more broadly, has covered the primary this time around, and how do you see it changing? Again, we welcome your comments at 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Josh, there's been a lot of discussion about endorsements, the role they used to play. I've been in the media long enough to remember that, wow, when the local paper came out for candidate X or candidate Y, it was a big deal. There was that coveted union leader endorsement, especially for Republicans. We heard in the episode how much Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama lobbied for that coveted Concord Monitor endorsement. Does anybody still care about endorsements from the local newspaper, Josh?
Well, I think candidates would just as soon have an endorsement than not. I think that the record would reflect that the endorsements, you know, don't often necessarily translate into wins. I mean, certainly on the Republican side, the union leader has a pretty spotty record of actually picking winners, which isn't to say that the people who do get the paper's support on the Republican side don't want it. But I believe it's been, I believe John McCain in 2008 was the last person that the union leader endorsed that actually won the New Hampshire primary and obviously didn't end up being the nominee. And, you know, endorsements, you look at people like, I think John Huntsman was endorsed by the most papers on the Republican side the last time when he ran. And obviously, you know, he didn't make it out of New
Hampshire.
A lot of
people saying, John who?
Yeah, in 2012. In 2016, did Donald Trump get endorsed by a single paper in New Hampshire? I don't think so. He obviously won the primary easily. And so, you know, endorsements, you know, maybe have never been what they're cracked up to be, but it was an essential part of how a lot of papers saw their role as vetting the candidates on behalf of voters.
Sort of that membrane that you described earlier, Josh. And this is a perfect segue into another guest that I want to bring into our conversation. Joining us now on the line is Howard Altshuler. He's executive editor and general manager of Seacoast Media Group, which includes the Portsmouth Herald and Foster's Daily Democrat. And Howard, a big welcome back. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Laura. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Good morning.
Well, we were just talking about editorial endorsements. What value do you think they have, Howard, for your readers and for your paper itself, or papers themselves, I should say? You've got several.
Right. Well, I mean, it's hard to, you know, measure exactly what the value is, but clearly, you know, a candidate's most valuable time, particularly in the home stretch of a primary race, is their time. And, you know, they give up, you know, an hour to 90 minutes of that valuable time to come and sit with the editorial board and, you know, and review the topics of the day. And so obviously they see a value in it. And
how many, you know, candidates sat with you all this time, Howard?
Yeah, we had all of them except for the president, who we did invite. And, I, you know, in my mind, I was like, you know, that could actually just happen. We're right out here at Pease, and maybe he flies in and, you know, piggybacks in on another event. But he was here in 2015, but he did not come back this cycle. And then the only other candidate we didn't get was Bernie Sanders. But every other candidate came in either in person. And then when the impeachment hit, we had to do a video conference with Amy Klobuchar from Washington, and we caught up with Elizabeth Warren while she was campaigning in Iowa through a video hookup. But
and you went with a video. You went with one of the candidates. You got the video hookup.
Exact two of them. Yeah.
Because you endorsed Klobuchar.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, she was the last person we talked to. And you know, as far as whether her campaign valued it, I mean, she stepped off the floor during a recess of the impeachment trial, and you know, tweeted about you know, that she was, you know, honored to receive the endorsement, and then went on the cable shows and talked about it, and you know, and not just us, but also the union leader and the Keene Sentinel and some of the papers she had gotten in Iowa, and so it has. I don't know. I think it has some value. You know,
well,
readers
yeah.
come to us every day for. You know, for information, and I think we put in the time, and we actually have a pretty interesting process here at Seacoast that I could talk about.
Well, I'd love to hear about that, but you probably heard Josh earlier say, Howard, while you were waiting to come on, that, you know, the track record of candidates who get these endorsements from newspapers actually winning isn't great. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, we absolutely don't look at it like, you know, we're going to help this person win. You know, the way that we look at it is we do the work and, you know, we put in the hours in order to give, you know, our readers a really informed opinion on the candidates. And, you know, it's not, you know, we're not all in for one candidate or another. We're saying we spoke with these candidates. Here's who we think, you know, would be the best president or the best governor or the best mayor in Portsmouth, whatever the case may be. And, you know, sometimes the voters agree with us and sometimes they don't. But, you know, we just try to give an honest opinion and also explain what that honest opinion is based on.
Sure. And so you wanted to describe the process for us, Howard,
right.
without too much detail. It was really interesting to hear in the episode of Stranglehold we just heard about sort of the long debates within the Concord Monitor's newsroom over who to endorse. So do you have long debates at Seacoast Media Group?
Right. Well, yeah. Yeah, we do. And our board is a little bit different in that we also have a lot of citizen advisors who serve on our editorial board, and their commitment to the process really helped drive it. I mean, they from the outset, you know, wanted to bring the candidates in and wanted to engage in the endorsement process. And we actually have a bipartisan group. We have folks like Doug Scammon, the former House Speaker, and Jackie Silly, who's a former state senator from Barrington and ran for governor. We have Jennifer Horn, who's the former New Hampshire GOP chair, and Dan Chartrand, who owns the Water Street Bookstore and is vice chair of the Rockingham Democrats, and Nancy Stiles. And, you know, we have a lot of people who come from various viewpoints, and the conversations we have are pretty awesome, you know, and they're the candidates come in knowing who's going to be in the room and knowing they're not going to necessarily get traditional newspaper editorial board questions, because that's not the life that some of our community advisors are living.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us as we talk about the role the New Hampshire media plays in the primary, especially this time around. Give us your thoughts about the coverage, what you've liked, what you don't like, and how you see the role of New Hampshire's traditional media, including NHPR, changing. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, use Twitter. Or one more time, you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. And Howard, stay on the line with us for a moment, if you could, please. I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Bina Venkatraman is with us now. She's editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. And Bina, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we were talking about the local media, and I'm going to include the Boston Globe in that because a lot of people in the Southern Tier read the Boston Globe. Your reporters cover the primary extensively. I'd just like your broad thoughts first, Bina, on how you see your paper's role in shaping the way people understand the primary.
Sure. So, you know, I speak mostly for the opinion enterprise and the editorial board and not for the newsroom, but of course I watch and admire the work of our newsroom reporters in covering the election and the campaigns and certainly the New Hampshire primary. But as an editorial board, we have been deliberating. We've been meeting with the presidential candidates, deliberating on an endorsement. But as you know probably by now, we've decided not to endorse in the New Hampshire primary because we have a broader point to make about that process as well as the Iowa caucus. But our intention is not to sort of relinquish the traditional editorial board role that we've played actually only since 1968 with the endorsement of Hubert Humphreys in the presidential election, presidential race. Our point is not to relinquish that role. It's rather to define it and to actually make it more powerful when we do endorse and have it really reflect our values. And so as we've been meeting with candidates and thinking about who we will endorse, we've been looking at how they align with our positions, how their character aligns with what's needed in the country. And certainly we've been considering, we don't have citizen advisors, so I found that to be a really interesting interesting model that Howard just described. But we did take on a number of reader questions this year. We had almost 1,000 reader questions come in on a range of topics, and that really also helped us prioritize what's important to voters, what's important to our readers, as they think about who to vote for in this really complex presidential primary field.
Oh, that's interesting. So you don't have a citizens advisory board like Howard does at Seacoast Media Group, sort of giving its input on what the perfect candidate, what qualities a perfect candidate should have. But you are hearing from your readers, Bina, about what they want you to consider in this endorsement. Is that new this time around?
It is new, and it's part of what I think really needs to happen in the evolution of editorial boards, which is to say that I don't think we can take for granted that our readers trust us and that they understand even how the black box of an editorial board works. And in the tradition of these boards, you know, the decisions and the deliberations and the endorsement interviews kind of all happen behind closed doors. And I think it's important to engage our readers to show that we actually are trying to, in some way, reflect some of their concerns or at least their areas of curiosity and how we do this process. And when we do make our endorsement, we'll be sharing actually a lot more than we have historically about how that process worked and making ourselves available to talk more transparently about that. But yes, we did solicit reader questions very specifically, and you know, this is not like a scientific polling of our readers, but we did see, for example, just an outpouring of questions around climate change, and that, I think, is very new for a presidential race to be so so influenced by that issue, and I think it speaks a lot to where we are with the climate crisis. It speaks a lot to the young voters who are coming into the electorate and really feel that this is a problem that affects their generation.
I want to ask you about an editorial that you wrote recently, Bina. Getting off the issue of endorsing candidates, you wrote recently, and I know you know what I'm going to ask you, kill the tradition. New Hampshire and Iowa should not go first. And in this editorial, you make the arguments that are often made that these two states are not representative of the country demographically or economically. Just a couple questions on that, Bina, if I could please. First of all, what's been the reaction from your Massachusetts readers and your sizable New Hampshire readers?
Well, it's been mixed. I think a lot of people feel that us standing for this principle and holding back our endorsement in the primary and really saying, you know, we need to question the whole process and even our role in that process, which I hope we can get to, and really look at the ways in which these two early, the primary and caucus in New Hampshire and Iowa, respectively, distort our electoral politics. There is a disproportionate influence that New Hampshire has played. And this tradition, by the way, of New Hampshire going first, as you'll know well, started a century ago. And the country has just changed so dramatically since then. And just to talk about this year's election, for example, where Latinos for the first time are expected to play a major force in the election and be the major non-white minority group voting in this election. Well, New Hampshire's percentage of Latino voters is a third of the country's percentage of Latino voters. Iowa doesn't fare much better. It's a 90% white state. The New Hampshire percentage of blacks is 1.7%, whereas the country's is more like 12%. But this is not just about race. It's also about age demographics, home ownership demographics, poverty. In a number of ways, New Hampshire is not representative of the country, and yet going first gives voters more influence. One study of the 2004 Democratic primary, for example, showed that voters in New Hampshire and Iowa in the primaries had each single voter in one of those two primaries had roughly the power of five voters on Super Tuesday or the later primaries. And that, I think, really shapes how the field moves. And we know, looking back to Jimmy Carter, that these early successes can either make or break candidates. They can bring candidates up from sort of not being known into being more better known, or even propel a campaign into winning the nomination.
So those economic and demographic factors, those are the things that you wrote in the editorial, Bina. And, you know, these arguments have been made for a long time now. You said you got a mixed reaction to this. Can you give us a sense of the people who didn't like what you had to say?
Sure. So I think, like a lot of New England traditions, there are many of us who cling to those traditions because they have some sort of meaning for us in our lives. And I have to say, as a New Englander married to a New Englander, I'm not a native New Englander, but I've been one now for more than a decade, that I understand those traditions, the 4th of July parades, the town meetings, and a lot of those are really valuable. And so I think some of the reaction we're getting from folks who are actually very conscientious primary voters in New Hampshire and Iowa and really participate in this process and take their civic role seriously is a bit of sort of, you know, why are you going after us? Why not give us this moment in the spotlight as small states? And I think my answer to that is not to say that New Hampshire and Iowa should never be first again, but that after a century of New Hampshire being first and decades of Iowa being first, we should be sharing the love. We should be rotating the primaries so that we, in any given presidential election year, have, let's say, a group of states that better reflect the demographics of the country along all different lines, including age, including race, including income and poverty, and that would provide a fairer process, and it would also allow the candidates who gain early momentum to be reflective of candidates who can actually marshal groups of voters when it comes to the general election. We know, for example, that it's going to be very hard for a Democrat to win the White House without voters of color, for example. So we want to know early in the process, it actually serves Democrats better, or Republicans, you might argue, at some point in the future, to have a more reflective primary process.
Well, Bina, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's Bina Venkataraman. She's editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Again, for the next 15 minutes here in The Exchange, we are looking at the media's role in the New Hampshire primary. We've been listening to a recent episode of NHPR's podcast Stranglehold called The Newsroom that looks at some of the themes raised around this. And we want to hear from you. Join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Howard Altshuler, Josh Rogers, let's go to our listeners. Reeve is calling in from Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. It's with great reluctance that I say, first of all, that the comment your guest just made that we should maybe share this around and rotate them makes me really sad because I love it here in New Hampshire, but it is a good point. But what matters to me is that there are individual citizens who meet and talk together, because once you've seen a candidate, it's a totally different feeling. We need that curating, whatever state it is, although I prefer it be New Hampshire. But my
you sound torn, point, Reeve.
But my primary point is this. I have been so frustrated this entire season, more than ever before, listening to the phrase, and others. So, Laura, you most particularly have done a stellar job of giving an hour at a time to candidates, and New Hampshire's good at that. But in the newscasts, this is New Hampshire, Maine, and it's national, that only money and name recognition are the two coin that allow us to choose people. When a newscaster on NHPR or anywhere else says there are candidates in the state today or candidates on the debate stage, there's this one, and several others, they've accidentally voted by removing name recognition for the very people that you're there to make sure get full air.
Well, Reeve, I really appreciate the point. And Howard, talk about the special challenge this year with so many candidates. I have heard other people make Reeve's point that, you know, everybody deserves a mention. On the other hand, time is tight and there are many, many names. So, Reeve, thank you so much for weighing in. Go ahead, Howard.
I mean, the thing that it's really a great honor for news organizations to be able to go out and, you know, and cover these candidates and meet them. And the one thing that you come away with is that even the candidates who are like polling at less than 1% are usually pretty fascinating people and have a lot to say. And you can learn a lot from them. So we try to give all the candidates as much coverage as our you know time and staffing allows. I think of Pete Buttigieg. I mean, how many people had ever heard of him before he showed up? And I remember he did a town hall meeting in Raymond, and it was standing room only. And people came back and said, "Wow, this guy was really impressive, and he really had the crowd going with him." And his star has really risen from being almost nowhere. Andrew Yang was not somebody that I think most of us knew much about before the primary process. He came in for an early editorial board, and we were very casual about it. Like, you know, okay, Andrew Yang, it'll be an interesting conversation. And he was fascinating. And, we went out and, afterwards read his book and saw, you know, his thoughts on what was causing kind of, disaffection with, the status quo in America. And, you know, the way he did a really good job identifying some of the causes of unrest among, people in the country. And, you know, these are fascinating conversations. So I agree. I mean, I think America loses if we don't try to give a platform to everybody.
Josh, same question to you. The challenge of presenting coverage of the primary that feels fair to listeners like Reeve. On the other hand, there's only so much airtime, and there are so many people this time around.
I mean, it's certainly a challenge, and you know, NHPR is fortunate enough to have enough staff to basically get out there, and we've tried to cover everybody in this race and have covered to some extent. You do have to make choices. I mean, you know, when Howard brings up Pete Buttigieg, I mean, it's interesting because I don't doubt what he says about this town meeting in Raymond. But, you know, to the extent that Pete Buttigieg rose, a lot of it was due to national media attention. A town hall meeting that took place on CNN was one that really caught a lot of people's attention. And, you know, kind of a canny media strategy by his campaign to get him in front of as many national reporters early in this race. And he had run for DNC chair, so his name was familiar, although many people couldn't pronounce it. That is really what sort of seeded his rise here as much as his ability to succeed with voters in New Hampshire and Iowa.
I'm so glad you raised that point, Josh. So talk a little bit more about that. The CNN town halls, you're absolutely right. Those have been big. They've held them in, you know, various states. There's a whole bunch going on right now as we speak at St. Anselm College. So in a way, right, it's great. CNN gives these candidates, you know, many, many hours. But that's a role that New Hampshire media has traditionally played.
Sure. I mean, in New Hampshire, I mean, you know, there's always New Hampshire has always been both the place where candidates interact with voters. And to Reeve's point, you know, the retail aspect of politics in New Hampshire and Iowa is something that people who, as she said, might be predisposed to accept the argument that maybe other states ought to go first. That is a valid concern, I think, that, you know, could you easily replicate the sort of retail political cultures that exist in Iowa and New Hampshire? That's perhaps the strongest argument that supporters of the current system make. Typically the role of New Hampshire has been, you know, the New Hampshire voters vet the candidates, the New Hampshire media vets the candidates. You know, there has always been an element of New Hampshire being, you know, I wouldn't say like a theme park for which the candidates run for president, but there is an aspect in which New Hampshire has always been a stage set for a campaign that is truly national in nature, and that has accelerated over the years. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Let's take another call. And again, our number 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And Howard and Josh, let's go to Roger calling in from Stratum. Hi, Roger. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, Laura.
Sure.
You know, my wife and I got rid of cable about 10 months ago. And as a consequence, we have learned more about the candidates through local media here in New Hampshire, through entrepreneurial journalism, online. The economy has hollowed out local media to the extent that I think there are more candidates than reporters in New Hampshire. Nevertheless, we've learned more about the candidates, more about their character, their policy, all because of the work that local media has done and the way that they have distributed their content in different channels. It's been terrific.
Very good. Well, Roger, good to hear from you. And Howard, that probably is making you smile there on the other end of the phone.
It is. And you know, it's so funny. We're such a small state. I know who Roger is. he writes letters to the editor and is very involved in politics in the state.
But in all seriousness, Howard, talk about what Roger says. You know, at some point it feels like there's more candidates than reporters. I mean, he's right. A lot of local newspapers have either folded or been hollowed out, as he says. So how do you still make it, you know, meaningful and of good quality on a real shoestring now at local papers?
Well, first, we work really, really hard. I mean, you know, there's a lot of us, you know, those of us on salary who often are working 7 days a week to make sure, you know, we have a standard that we've set for ourselves through the years, and we really try to uphold that. And it's tiring, but we believe in what we're doing, and it's important to us. And, you know, we really... You know, the Globe editor mentioned, you know, reaching out to readers to get their questions, and we did the same thing. And as I was thinking about this show and the media's role, I think what our real role is using the access that we have to give access to our readers, to the candidates, and helping them get their, you know, their thoughts to the people who are looking to run the country. Now, in 2008, we had a lot more staff and a lot more room in our building, and we actually hosted forums here with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and John McCain and Joe Biden and John Edwards, on and on. And that was one way of providing access. This year, you know, we reached out. We asked for their questions to share with the editor, you know, with the candidates when they came in for the editorial boards. And we also live-streamed most of our editorial board meetings so people could see exactly what the conversation was. And then the other thing that happens is right now we have an incredible op-ed section where I'm receiving hundreds of letters every week and publishing as many of them as fast as I can. And people really want to engage in the political process. And one thing we can do that social media can't do or doesn't do, chooses not to, is that we ensure a civil debate. I don't let people attack one another personally. And when they do attack one another personally, I'll write back to them and say, you know, hey, I'm going to afford you the same protection if someone attacks you. Let's stick to the ideas and not beat up on each other.
Well, Roger, it's great to hear from you. And we got an email from Laura, who says she works for the Naki Loeb School of Communications. Laura says, as the state's only standalone communication school, we see an increase this year in students wanting to take classes in content production like digital media, podcasts, video, and print. The interest, Laura says, in citizen journalism is strong, but will not fill the space of declining professional reporters and editors. So Laura says she's asking, how do we teach people the skills of news gathering and production, while also instilling an appreciation for consuming news of high integrity and ethics from local, independent, professional news sources? And Howard, I'll throw that to you, and then Josh, I have another sort of related question. So go ahead, Howard.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'll throw on another hat, which is that I'm also the president of the New Hampshire Press Association. And this year, we're in the process working with some other journalism groups in the state and putting a mentorship program in place. Where we try to pair up seasoned journalists with either, you know, folks who are, you know, students who are still in college or just graduating, who can kind of, you know, be there available to them to answer their questions, to guide them, to, you know, if they're facing a thorny issue, you know, helping them think it through. So that's in process. We also just opened up our contest this year to college journalists, and so we're going to start seeing some of their work in the annual press you know better newspaper contest. So we're aware of the need to bring the next generation along, and then of course most of our newsrooms have good internship programs, and you know when we do have positions open, a lot of times those are the people we hire, the interns, because we know them, we know their work, and we know their work ethic.
Well, Laura, it's a big topic, and we could probably talk a lot more about it, but we will wrap it up there for now. We, of course, have internships and fellowships here at NHPR as well. Howard Altshuler, thank you very much for helping us out. I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Great, thanks.
That's Howard Altshuler, executive editor and general manager of Seacoast Media Group. And Josh Rogers, thank you very much as well. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Lauren.
You can go to nhpr.org/exchange for a lot more resources while we're talking about coverage and finding out about the candidates. You can look at our candidate tracker. You can look at reporting by Josh and the rest of our team. And you can find links to Stranglehold, our podcast about the New Hampshire primary, including, if you want to hear it again, that episode, The Newsroom, that we played earlier. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.